I had my children on the floor. I was on my favourite blanket that my grandmother gave me on the floor like a cat.
And I realised in that moment the potential of what our bodies can really do as women.
Like, I could feel his head. I could do my own internal, like, yeah, his head, I could feel it.
I was in tears. I was just in tears and overwhelmed with gratitude.
Hi, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast, the podcast that is bringing embodied birth wisdom from women from all over the world sharing their natural birth stories. Don't forget to subscribe and download so that you can always have access to these empowering and positive natural birth stories. Hi, my name is Anna, also known as the Spiritual Midwife, and I am the Natural Birth Podcast host. I'm a midwife and a childbirth educator, and I work with women worldwide, assisting them in having an empowering and natural birth experience and to truly claim their birth as a rite of passage. I offer online one-on-one sessions, packages, and online courses for the conscious mamas who don't want to leave their birth up to chance. If you want to know more about me and what I do in the world, then please visit me at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or connect with me on Instagram as the_spiritual_midwife. Now, if you love this podcast, then please consider taking a moment right now and leave a review. They mean the world to me, and is also your way of helping me reach more women around the world with these natural and empowering birth stories. Together, we are changing the birth narrative, one birth story at a time. Happy week of the solstice, dear podcast family. What a special time of the year this is. My week has been full of festivities and celebration of the light, love, life, and community. I so very perfectly started my monthly bleed on the new moon on the Monday and had a beautifully soft and gentle solstice day on the Wednesday, deep in beingness in the glorious forest, having a long morning practice in the garden, and ending my day at a solstice celebration amongst dancing feet and folk music by the water in nature. Here in Sweden, we officially celebrate midsummer as a country on the Friday, somewhere between the 19th and 25th of June, whenever the Friday falls in the calendar closest to the solstice. And so I did as well. I spent Friday day and night with my family and friends eating and drinking and playing games in my brother's garden and enjoying the hot summer's day and long light night together. And the rest of this weekend was spent in even more festivities at a spiritual festival here in Stockholm. What a week! Truly in the spirit of summer solstice, which is all about celebrating life and fertility, joy and community. And I celebrate you. I celebrate that this podcast has brought me so much beauty and community. So many of you have found your way over to my online village, where I get to hang out with you daily, or choosing to work with me one-on-one. And some of you are now journeying with me in my Spiritual Midwife Mentorship Program. I'm so very grateful to know you and to be weaving my life together with yours in one way, shape, or form. And speaking of the Spiritual Midwife Mentorship Program, I'm here to officially announce that the second intake for the mentorship will be happening already in September this year. The interest has been great, and I'm so grateful for that. True space holders for the rite of passage of birth are so very, very much needed right now in our world. So I am opening up for a second cohort to start already in September. The feedback from the current mentees are that the mentorship is exceeding their expectations and they are loving the depth to which we travel and the warm, supportive sisterhood and container that is being provided and created for them. I will begin discovery calls for the September mentorship already next week. So if you are interested in becoming a sacred space holder for birth and a physiological birth advocate, then head on over to thenaturalbirthcourse.com and find out more about the mentorship and apply for our September intake. Now let's dive into today's episode. Today on the Natural Birth Podcast, we have Amy Aroha. Amy is originally from New Zealand, today living in Australia, and she is a wild mother and transpersonal birth mentor. She generously takes us through her first hospital birth at the young age of 24 and her initiation into motherhood. And then we weave deeply into red threads and birth imprinting and rite of passages and women's power in her rites and in birth. And Amy then continues to share how her life took a turn as she moved from the big city smoke of Sydney into nature in northern New South Wales, meeting a new partner and then becoming pregnant again, and how this time she made very different choices. She employed an independent home birthing midwife for her second pregnancy, but ended up birthing before her midwife arrived. And when she became pregnant a third time, she decided for a fully wild pregnancy and free birth with just her family. Curious about Amy? Find her on Instagram as Rip Snorter.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really happy to be here today. It feels like a really nice container to sit in with you. Thanks for having me.
Beautiful to have you. I've wanted to hear about your beautiful birthing journeys for a while now, and I'm so grateful that we found a time. This is my last week in Australia, actually. So, so we're in the same time zone, which is, you know, great for kind of clear-headedness and not being, like, you know, late at night and early morning. So I'm really grateful to have you here, and I would love for you to take us on your journey from, you know, falling pregnant the first time, the first birth, the second and the third, and the progression from the first being in the hospital to, you know, a cared for pregnancy, but a free birth, unassisted birth, and then finally to your wild pregnancy and wild, undisturbed free birth at home. So take us on the journey, Amy. Share with us.
My favorite subject in the whole world to discuss is birth. So I'm very, very happy to share, especially the parts about the progression, as you named, you know, and the journey, the personal journey that unfolded from my daughter's birth 10 years ago to my son's birth just 17 months ago. So I fell pregnant when I was 24. With my partner at the time. And I had always wanted to be a mother. I knew I would have a daughter. It was just like such a deep cellular desire to have a child. And I was always really excited to give birth as well. It was never something that I was afraid of or that I perceived as scary or unnatural in any way. I was always genuinely excited to give birth to my children. So when I fell pregnant, I was absolutely ecstatic, you know, and my partner, we were so young and so naive in a lot of ways and still had a lot of healing that would come and unfold. And birth has been such an integral part of that journey. So my pregnancy, where to begin? I haven't actually reflected on my daughter Elia's birth for so long, but our pregnancy was really easy.
It was really very by the book in terms of how I navigated, you know, the rites and rituals of the medical system. I didn't think, although I knew birth was a natural, normal experience, I didn't think outside of what was kind of presented to me as the mainstream option. I was the first person out of my social group to have a child. I was born in hospital. I hadn't been exposed to home birth. Just wasn't in my realm of consciousness, you know? Mm. And so I just kind of went with what you do, which is, you know, showing up to the GP and then getting the scans and doing all the tests. And I had no problem with that at the time. Hindsight is always 2020, you know, when you're looking at experience.
And it's such a common start though, isn't it? Like, just like you said, like just, you know, doing what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. Mm. And it really excited me, to be honest. Like, I really loved going to my midwife appointments, although I had a different midwife every single time. As you know, when you're navigating the system, I didn't have continuity of care. I didn't even know what continuity of care was at that time, you know. So it was more so the ritual and the time that allowed me to focus on being pregnant. It's like, oh, today's our midwife appointment. You know, I get to go be measured, or we go hear the baby's heartbeat, or whatever the thing was I was excited about. And this is something that I reflect on now quite a lot as I work in the birth world and support people throughout their pregnancies, is we crave those rites and rituals, you know, except in the modern dominant culture, those rites and rituals ancestrally would be, you know, gathering with wise women, our aunties, our grandmothers, prenatals within the family, you know, our intuition. And now they've kind of been replaced with these outsourced rites and rituals of the medical system. So, pregnancy was easy for me and exciting. And when it came time towards the end of my pregnancy, I hadn't really done any kind of preparation in terms of, you know, spiritual work or self-work or anything other than the antenatal class that they teach you, that they do in the hospital system, you know, which is like, this is the needle we use for an epidural, and these are the forceps that we might have to use, and, you know, like putting a nappy on a doll. That was the kind of birth prep that I was doing. It's like, mm-hmm. So one-dimensional, right?
So limited and so very medicalized, like prepping you to be a good compliant, you know, client of that hospital
patient. Exactly. Absolutely. Yes. Patient. Right. Yeah. But, you know, even doing that was exciting to me, you know, just knowing that it was the symbolism of that, you know, the baby's coming and I'm going to be a mother soon. And so when I went into labor, I woke up in the morning, it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I felt that first just awareness in my womb. It was just like enough to wake me up out of my sleep. And my partner had already gone to work. I kind of tried to go back to sleep, and about half an hour later was awoken again by that same sensation. And I just knew, I think, you know, it's just that intuition. It's this sensation that my body wasn't familiar with. I knew something was happening. And so first thing I did was call the midwife at the RPA in Sydney, which is like the where I was born, actually, is where I birthed my daughter. And I said, I lost my mucus plug. That's right. And that's when I called them. And I called them and I said, I lost my mucus plug. And I said, look, it's your first baby. It could be days. You know, just do what you're going to do, which is great advice. You know, like, do what you're going to do. Have a bath, like, go for a walk. And so I did all those things. I potted around and went for a walk. And the sort of pains were getting more and more, like, noticeable. I remember I lived right in the heart of the inner city, and this dude stopped me in the middle of the street and just started having a yarn with me. Like, I was like, I think I'm having a contraction because I'm going to have a baby soon. I'm just in this sort of small talk conversation. That was just life at that time in the heart of the inner city. And I went and visited my partner, and we were so excited. And then I went home, and he didn't finish work until late that afternoon. And so I just spent the day by myself, which I realize now is a pattern for me, that when I birth, I like to have time. It just naturally unfolds that way, that I have several hours where I'm just on my own. So it makes sense that I've enjoy free birth, right? That's my choice of how I would always birth from now. And so I just spent that time, like, I don't know, nesting, and I made pasta and did my thing, and my partner came home, and that's when things really started to elevate. And we were watching like some asinine movie with Nicolas Cage in it. So not a birth vibe, but we were just in our zone at home and kind of just like going on as normal. And then until the sensations got so intense that, you know, I couldn't really, there was no real break. And my partner was saying, you know, we should go to the hospital. It's happening, you know, it's time to go. And just this deep, like, primal feeling of not wanting to leave the house. I didn't want to go. And I, at one point, actually ran upstairs and was on the bed and turned all the lights off and was like on all fours on the bed. And he came up, he's like, what are you doing? You know, I think we have to go to the hospital. I said, I'm not going. And he called the midwife, and she said, let me hear her have a contraction. And she said, oh, she doesn't sound like she's close enough to come in anyway. And he said, look, I know my partner. I know that I can just sense that this is happening and it's almost time. And I could start to feel pressure in my perineum and just a different sensation, you know, like things were changing. Somehow he convinced me to get off the bed. I was like on all fours, like an animal, basically just like growling. And he basically said, not in so many words, can't do this. We have to go to the hospital and it's going to be okay. Let me just help you go. I'm going to go get the car. And so he went down to get the car. I walked downstairs. Walking down the stairs, I had like two contractions, so it was time, you know, but I didn't know how close I was to it actually happening. And I remember walking past, we had this big like floor to ceiling mirror in the lounge room, and walking past, and I could see my pubic bone was like bulging out, like that area, which is obviously my daughter's head, you know, ready to come out. And I got in the car. Oh, I can feel like the somatics of it when even just thinking about it, and having to drive through the city and all of the lights, the movement of the car. And I was just like weeping because I just was in such a state of overstimulation and the pain. It wasn't even so much about the pain. It was just the environment was not conducive to holding the pain, you know, and the car ride was like hell. It was just hell. So we got to the hospital, had to find a park, you know, in like a busy city hospital, and then got out of the car and walked to the maternity ward, and was just having multiple contractions as I was walking and like having to go on my hands and knees and, got into the hospital and they said, oh, she doesn't look like she's in enough pain. It's her first baby. You're probably going to have to go home.
Oh my goodness.
And, I ended up going into an examination room. So it wasn't a birthing suite. I went into the examination room, and they gave me a vaginal exam and I was 7 or 8 centimeters. And then, it was just this tiny little room, like where you go to wait, you know, when you're in hospital. What I'm really grateful for, though, in that scenario is that I didn't have time to put on a gown. They didn't get to put me in a gown. I just had my dress on. So I got to stay in my own clothing, which I think can be really integral to like maintaining that sense of self. And I'm not actually sick. I'm not a patient.
Yeah.
I'm just birthing a baby.
Yes.
So, at this point, I was clearly in transition now, looking back and saying, I want an epidural. Where's the epidural? And at this point, they gave me a vaginal exam while I was contracting. And I was saying, no, I don't want it. I don't want it. Stop. And they said, you're 10 centimeters. And at that point, like everything kind of stopped and or like slowed down. It's like this weird stillness that comes over in birth, I feel, or in my experience.
Absolutely. When
you move through transition, it's like grace enters the room.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in pain anymore when it came time to push my daughter out. And yeah, I was like, okay, if I just do this, if I focus all my energy in this downward motion, I'll just get this done and this will be over and she'll be here. And so three pushes and she just came slithering out as they do. There were two midwives. There was a male midwife or nurse and then a female midwife. I can't even remember her name. I don't even know who she was. Yeah, I'm not sure. And they were thankfully standing at the other side of the room. So they really stood back and let me birth her. And I kind of pulled her up and pulled her onto my chest and she was still purple. And I watched her go and take her first breath and her skin turned from purple to pink, pinker, you know, that beautiful baby pinkness. She had no vernix. And then she just went, meh, and did one little squawk. I said, it's been you in there, hello. And she just was so perfect. And yeah, and then she kind of went immediately to my breast from memory. And my partner had to sit down because he felt like he was going to pass out. He had to sit down and have a rest. And that's where, you know, I got that moment. I got to be with her. I didn't put her down. But that's when the hustle and bustle started, yeah. You know, where they're like everybody has to, all the professionals in the room have to kind of like make their role, justify their role, like make themselves seem important in some way. And first of all, they did say, now that's how you have a baby after she's born. But then they said, oh, look, you know, they didn't ask me to give me Cinto. They just gave me, I don't even remember birthing my placenta.
Wow.
Because they didn't ask. Or they did, but I'm in an altered state of consciousness. Yes. You don't actually can't make informed decisions.
No.
When you are in that state of bliss.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember birthing my placenta. And then they said, oh, your blood could be thinning. So we need to give you a catheter. And I was like, what? And I like got up and was walking around and was fine. Just, you know, didn't really understand. And so then I ended up they gave me a catheter. And so I went from just like powerfully birthing my baby completely naturally in my dress to being in a hospital gown with a catheter after birthing my baby totally normally, you know, without incident.
Yeah. So did they, was it, I've never heard that thinning, your blood is thinning. Was it a lot of blood? Is that what, like, was not, hemorrhage?
Like, oh. Knowing what I know now,
yeah,
there's no abnormal amount of blood.
Yeah.
Did they, at the time, it's like, you know, I don't know.
No, of course.
I'm going to take the advice of whoever is the professional in the room. And so that happened. And then we waited for a long time before we could get transferred into a birthing suite.
Right. You birthed in that little room that you were checked in because it went so fast. I just want to ask you one thing, because did you voice that you wanted to birth your own baby, that you wanted to catch your own baby? Did you voice that why they stood back and, you know,
I don't know. I can't remember if I voiced it. I may have, but it was me and my partner pulled her up. It could have been because it happened so quickly. I don't know. I don't know. But I'm really grateful for that that I was given, because I really clearly remember them being, you know, at the end of the bed and just witnessing what was happening and not inserting themselves into that moment. They inserted themselves after, but you know, in that moment, which is such a sacred moment, that was our moment.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then I spent a night in the hospital And I ended up saying, this catheter is fucking ridiculous. Can you take it out? I don't need it. I'm fine. And had to really advocate for myself to have the catheter taken out.
Yeah.
I went home the next day and didn't have any postpartum care, didn't know that postpartum care was a thing, you know, had my like 6 midwife visits where they come to your house, you know, and just like weigh the baby and how's your breastfeeding and...
Yeah, that's a lot though, like 6 weeks. It's changed now. I think in Sydney would not be more than around 2, max 4, but I think 2 is standard now. That's Australia. In many countries, there's no visits at home. In Sweden, where I'm from, you actually, as a mother, have to leave your own home the first week to go into hospital to have your baby's checkups with the midwives. They don't come to your home. So, you know, it is at least a service that is provided in Australia.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. Wow. I did not know that. Yeah. Having to leave the house is just its whole own journey that we should not even be embarking on, you know, within those first few weeks, let alone the first week.
Yeah. That's taking, you know, the pregnancy, birth, and postpartum is not a sickness.
Right.
You know, a place that it shouldn't be, like, oh, well, you're not sick, so you can go. You know, instead of going like, no, she's not sick, but she just birthed life. Let's care for her. Like, it's just crazy to me that that's not how you view women and mothers and the amazing gift that women are giving humanity every day.
And our pelvic floor, let's just name that. Our pelvic bowl should not be... doing anything in that first week, you know, even just on that really like logistical level of the physiology of the body, I think it just speaks to the broader social and cultural issues, right, of the devaluing of mothers and the work of motherhood.
Massively. Yeah.
Birth of Aelia.
That's my first birth. How amazing. I mean, for a first time, you know, mother having that experience, and also 10 years ago, you know, today it has changed that now it's different around the world, but it's been seen that with vaginal birth, if you bleed more than 500 mils, which is not a lot, then it's a hemorrhage, right? And then, yeah, it might be, you know, syntocinone, other drugs, catheter, all these, you know, things done to you. But if you had a cesarean, it's not seen as like, then you can have a liter, and that's the same. Like if it's not over a liter, it's not a hemorrhage. And now, which you think is logical, right? Now, oh no, or maybe if she has a vaginal birth and it's a liter or under a liter, it's still not a hemorrhage. Yeah, of course. Like why would it be a difference? But that's how it's been viewed. And, you know, I know many women who can have up to a liter and she's holistically well, walking around breastfeeding her baby, like straight after birth, like, and it's not affected. And I've seen some women who've had like 200 mils, 300 mils and feeling so affected. It depends how nourished you are. It depends on your constitution. It depends on so many factors, not just the actual blood loss, right?
Thank you so much for naming that. It's so important for people to realize like how you feel is actually more often than not more significant than how much blood you can see with your eyes, you know, and it just speaks to how the institution, you know, looks at things so one-dimensionally and isn't actually providing person-centered, woman-centered care.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's not easy to estimate blood loss either if you don't actually weigh, right? So in hospital, you can weigh, and that's done. Like if you think that, oh, this is probably too much, you weigh it to see like it's this much. It's hard to estimate just with the eye, and midwives, doctors, everyone will have, like when you do practice runs in hospitals, right? When you train to be a midwife, whatever, everyone will guess different things. Like it's really hard. It's not like everyone just knows, oh, that looks like 500 mils. Or that looks like, you know what I mean as well. So sometimes in hospital, geared professionals will act quicker than is needed, because they are scared of that blood. And they don't look at the holistic picture of a woman going like, well, actually she's like not showing any signs of this being too much for her.
Yes. Yes. That's why I say like you know, if we're going to work in birth, we have to do our healing work. We can't be going in there into that sacred space with a woman with our triggers and our trauma, our own birth trauma, you know, the things that we've experienced in our lives that create a threshold within us, you know. And so I think so many people within that system are not aware of their own thresholds. So they're projecting that, and it's impacting women's experiences in really horrific ways. I'm really grateful that Aelia's birth went the way that it did. Given what I know now and how I know it could have gone, more so, like a little bit deeper than that, is gratitude for my ancestral imprinting and primal knowing that I wanted to stay home, you know.
Yes. For as long as I love that. I was actually going to ask you about that, like, but you said you were born in hospital, but do you have a, you know, with your maternal lineage or the women in your family, have they birthed easily or naturally, or do you have, is that just like your imprint?
I think for me, it's probably more so my paternal side, where Māori, so we were only very recently colonized as a peoples. And so it was only a few generations ago, you know, my great grandmother's generation, where birth was at home, you know, with the extended family, within our kinship systems. So I'm really grateful that I have that Indigenous knowing in my body that I feel really impacts my perception of birth, and knowing, you know, on that really deep level that, like, this is just a human animal thing.
Yeah.
And this is how it needs to be done. My mom had quite a traumatic birth with me. And then my grandmother had four children. Never heard a thing about it. It was fine. It was fine. I was up and doing things the next day. It's so skinny the next day. You know, it was just like how much motherhood, how much birth didn't impact her, which is really like that cultural martyrdom stuff, you know, that like we don't want to see how much motherhood impacts a person. We don't want to acknowledge that birth is like the most profound initiation a woman has in her life and the power that's available through that.
Mm-hmm.
We just want to show how much it doesn't impact us and we can just get on with our lives, right?
We can be like any man.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Exactly that, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was kind of my maternal story. In saying that, Mum never projected her fear onto me. You know, she was never, but I certainly carried, I've done a lot of work around my birth imprinting through rebirthing breath work and actually experienced my birth in one of my breathes, and the fear that I felt as a newborn as I was emerging into that space.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's huge what we carry. But yeah, it's just been a knowing for me that it's not something to fear. It's not something to fear. So I'm really grateful for that, because it's really countercultural. You know, the culture tells us that birth is something to fear, that it is unnatural. It needs to be managed, needs to be micromanaged. You know, you don't actually know what's going on in your body. We know, and we hold that power, and this system and institution holds that power. Mm. And I mean, it's everywhere, right? Like in the movies that we watch, in the imagery that we see related to birth. The message is clear, like you should be afraid of this.
Absolutely. And that the danger is the woman and the woman's body, that we need to manage the woman's body. That is primarily the message, isn't it, with all the diagnoses that women get and the induction epidemic that is happening around the world, because she's going over her due date, because she's too big, because she's this and that, right? It's all about the woman and pathologizing her. And I love, you know, just speaking to this, because you know, I speak to this in my mentorship for birth workers, that, you know, we need, just what you said, and I love that you bring this up, like we need to unravel ourselves and understand what we carry into the birth space. And one of that is definitely, you know, going back in our ancestry line, our maternal lineage, the birthing culture of our lineage. And, you know, because we know that epigenetics, transgenerational trauma is carried through the generations. And so we will just play that out both in our own birthing, but also as birth workers, we will carry on that imprinting into that space. Mm.
Yes.
So important.
Yes, yes, yes.
To unravel that before you.
Language. Yeah.
If you truly want to be a sacred space holder for birth, like, yes, you can attend a birth and, you know, do fluffy, beautiful things like Rebozo, so like acupressure points and, you know, and many people do. But if you truly want to hold a deep space for someone in that portal, you need to realize the effect that you have, that you come with.
Absolutely. Yes. Like, how much can I sit in the mystery and allow it to be the mystery and to just like kneel in that space and to not make it about myself? Ooh. It's really like the opportunity for healing and expansion for us is like just phenomenal within the realm of birth. You know, it's really, I mean, that's why it's so suppressed and oppressed, right? And just what we were naming before about the pathologizing of women's bodies. It's like this historical story around our shameful, disgusting bodies.
Yeah.
Right? That our bodies are shameful, they're disgusting, our blood is disgusting, our pleasure is disgusting. Mm. So of course our birth is disgusting. And we, you know, patriarchy, the institutions, we need to take control of that because you're, you know, you're too shameful. Mm. And too like disconnected from God or source is the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could go on a total tangent. I feel like this.
Absolutely. Preach, sister. I am so on with you with all of this. It needs to be a big reclaiming of our menarche, our, you know, birthing, menopause, our big rights as women. Like, all of them has been medicalized and dominated and controlled and pathologized, where our power lies as women.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, we have a whole generation of women that are medicated out of being women from their very early teens. I think that's when you think about it, it's so scary, but it is an awakening happening right now all over the world of women remembering the old ways and reconnecting to her story and understanding the power we hold in, especially in birth.
Calling you the mystics. Mothers, maidens, and magas, the nurturers, healers, birth workers, midwives, doulas, and nurses, the seers and visionaries, shamans and changemakers, and you, their rebel ones. You who recognize birth as a sacred portal and a life-altering event worthy of honoring and safeguarding. You who want to walk alongside women through her rite of passage from maiden to mother and provide a safe, sacred, and physiological birth space. Here is your invitation to apply for the Spiritual Midwife Mentorship Program starting in September. A full year's container of learning, embodying, and deepening into a true space holder and sacred advocate for a woman's rite of passage of birth. By weaving ancient and modern knowledge of her story, women's wisdom, physiological birth skills, and the art of sacred space holding, this program is unique to its kind as it also offers transformational one-on-one mentoring with me, personally assisting you in becoming the clear channel and the best space holder that you can be. You will be held, nurtured, and supported for a whole year inside our worldwide spiritual midwife community as you learn and embody the teachings and skills and start sharing your gifts with the world. This mentorship program is for you who feel a deep calling to serve as the custodian of the sacred at the birth altar, whose intuition is ringing clear as you receive this invitation. Find out more and apply at thenaturalbirthcourse.com.
So let's dive on into your second birth story.
So my ex-partner and I, we raised our daughter together, and then we decided to separate from our romantic relationship, but we remained, you know, very close friends and family. and co-parented beautifully. And so it was 6 years that I was 6 years, no, 3 years that I was a single mother. And in that time I left the city, I moved to the mountains. So this little shack out in the bush, I left the city to do some really deep healing and self-work. I needed to unplug myself from the environment that I was existing in. And so then I met my love, Nick, and we had like a very epic and wild and intense beginning to our love story. It was very much like, you're who I'm going to be with, you know, that's you're my person, but we have a lot of shit to figure out. So having children wasn't really on the like top of our list, right? I took a long time to really like sink into that relationship, although we were so in love. And then the call started to happen, which was like possession of wanting, or no, it wasn't even so much wanting, it was like this child that wanted to come through, and I was like a woman possessed. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just like, I just can't stop thinking about them. I can't, like, it's consuming so much of my mind space. And I just want us to sort our shit out, you know, so we can let this baby come through. And we did a lot of work around, you know, our coupledom, our relationship, but also as individuals. And it was like, as soon as the pathway was more clear, I fell pregnant, and it was so right. And so, it was just such a, like, of course, and this is who's meant to come through, you know, this was always meant to happen. And so I was living in this little mountain cottage. Nick was still living in the city, and he would come and stay and then go back to the city. And so I was pregnant, like, for a good few months, maybe half the pregnancy on my own, like up in the mountains. And that was really beautiful for me. You know, I really liked that time. It was something I hadn't experienced before, of really just being with myself and being with nature in that way, and my daughter, of course. And we decided to have a home birth. I say decided, but it wasn't really even a discussion. It was like, obviously, we're going to birth this baby at home. You know, it just was. This is how we live our lives. These are our values. I don't go to a doctor. Why would I birth my baby in a hospital? It was just, you know, obviously we're going to birth this baby at home. So then came our mission of finding someone who was aligned with their values. And we met Melanie Jackson. You might know Mel, the midwife. She has a great podcast as well, The Great Birth Rebellion.
Bloody love that podcast. So, like a gift, such a gift.
Mm. She's so generous with her knowledge. And this was what I loved about Mel so much, is she is just like so rooted in her trust of the woman, and in her, like, yeah, in her trust in us to make the right decisions for ourselves. There was no, you know, you and I were talking about like being a clear channel, essentially, and not projecting our shit onto our clients. And she's like such an embodiment of that. And so I really mark my connection with Mel, my meeting with Mel, as my journey into birth work as well, because she became almost immediately my mentor, you know, where our prenatals were more just me like sitting, kneeling at her feet, you know, and like, what about this? And what about that? What happens if that happens? And tell me this story, you know, and just like absorbing it all. And it was, for me, that was the greatest birth preparation I could have had, because it was wise woman stories and it was other women's stories that I was marinating in that whole time. It wasn't, you know, these medicalized rituals and rites that were replacing, you know, what our actual craving is, which is to be like fully seen and held and trusted. Mm-hmm. And so we had beautiful prenatal care with Mel. It was so special. She ended up almost immediately, you know, becoming such a great friend. But when it came time to birth, I woke up, it was 3 a.m. and I just had that same sensation that I named with my daughter, and I just laid in bed, and my daughter was actually sleeping. We were co-sleeping. She had a little bed next to mine. Nick had a really bad headache. He was sleeping out by the fire. And so I was just alone in the bed, where I stayed for about 2 hours. I was just like tracing my body and just like touching myself and talking to the baby, and just letting him know, like, this is going to be a really big journey and it's okay. We're going to do it together, and you don't need to be scared because we've got this. And that time was so sacred, you know, to have that communion with my child and really to feel him hearing me say that. It's making me emotional. And so I went out into the lounge room when I felt ready, and I said, I think it's time. And in our house, it was just a really tiny house. We had the fire going, and it was May, so it was really bloody cold, but it was so cozy in our place. And Nick kind of had really fixated in his mind on getting to like 40 weeks, and I was 38 weeks. And he was like, but it's not, we've still got a couple of weeks. I'm like, baby, it's not how it works. He's like, oh, well, okay. I said, look, I'm going to be here. You rest, because he had this really bad headache. And so he just laid for a bit, and I sat by the fire and was kind of leaning on the table and just swaying and moving. And I could feel the baby moving, and, you know, I could just really see. It was so visual, that birth experience of like what was happening for him and what was going on like a cosmic level of, he's like traveling through these realms, you know, he's just right there. He's only a few inches away, and yet he's traveling through these other dimensions to come to Earth. And finally, Nick kind of was like, okay, this is, we're on. I'm going to set up the pool. Got up, started pottering around. My daughter woke up. He was setting up the pool, and like lit the candles and the fairy lights and had all the beautiful smells going and all the things that I wanted. My daughter came out and was, you know, you're doing so good, mummy. You're doing so good. Can I watch Harry Potter now? I wanted to go watch a movie. And so it really was very much Nick and I. And as it started to get more intense, I was kind of kneeling on the lounge, and our lounge was right under the window, and the window overlooked the horizon of the mountains where we lived. And he was like kneeling in front of me, and I looked up and could see the sun starting to rise over the mountains. I knew it was going to be time soon. And then he left the room, and I felt this like surge to move from being on all fours back into like kind of squatting, but leaning back, squatting on my feet and leaning up, rearing up and back. And my waters released all over the lounge. And it was just the most like sensational, best feeling ever, as I'm sure anyone whose waters have broken in such a way can attest to. Yeah. And I just knew it was time. I said, his head's out. He's coming. He's coming. And everyone, my partner and Elia, ran in and were kneeling at my feet. And his little ear emerged first. And then his little face came out. And then he just flew out. I didn't have to push. He just absolutely flew out like a rocket into Nick's arms. And yeah, he just held him for a moment. I realized now I had like fetal ejection.
Yes.
Reflex. Yeah.
And that's something that only happens when we fully allow physiology to happen undisturbed, right? Like the oxytocin receptors just get, you know, just the height of oxytocin creates that, right? And which mostly happen at home.
Yes. Yes, it was the most like so much power just shooting out of my body in such a fast way. And yeah, so he had held, oh, I didn't mention he'd messaged Mel like a few moments before Ember came out, because I was saying, leave her alone. She's at home with the kids. Let her sleep. And he's like, but we're paying her. She should be here. And I said, no. And then he ended up messaging her when I said, okay, when he was almost coming out, and said, he's coming. And then the next message she got was, he's here. Cause he emerged, and about 20 minutes later, Melanie arrived. Nick kind of like had him and then was like, here you go, and passed him to me. And Yeah, it was just so, I just remember like the redness of the room and everything, like the fire lighting the room and just feeling like I was in the cave, you know, and it was so conducive to birth and it was so warm and almost womb-y, you know, in that space. It was just the perfect environment to birth in that way and for birth to unfold so optimally. And Melanie came in and made us a cup of tea and, you know, tidied up. Didn't get to use the pool because it all happened so quickly. So I was in active labor probably for 2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. I spent 2 hours in bed having that communication with Zevon and then 2 hours actually laboring out by the fire. And then my placenta emerged and, you know, that was so healing because that had been taken from me in Elia's birth. So just letting placenta have the time to come out and then Mel being so respectful of the placenta and saying, look, you know, showing us and showing my daughter and, yeah, allowing for delayed cord clamping. We kept Zevon attached for so long and these are things that are, like, culturally significant for me. Yeah, it was a really redemptive experience and really true to who Zevon is. Like, he's just, like, full throttle, you know, knows what he wants, shooting around like a rocket all the time. It's like he is his birth imprint. It was a really, really beautiful experience.
Mm. I love that. I love that. Yeah, the beautiful placenta. I feel so deeply like the need for reclaiming the wisdom of the placenta in birth because, you know, most women, even having a natural physiological birth, wherever, home, birth center, hospital, disregard the placenta and the birth of the placenta, but also just discard it, like in human waste.
Yes.
And I feel like it needs to be honored and reclaimed. And for me personally, and this is not for everybody, but I really feel the need for it to go back to the earth in an honoring way. To complete the cycle, like, you know, it's, yeah, I just get goosebumps when I talk about it.
Yeah, yes, it is our first holistic nourishment. So in Te Reo Māori, we say whenua, we call the placenta whenua, but we call the land whenua. So it's the same word because placenta is our first land. It's our first home, our guardian. So we have to, you know, offer that back to the earth for that child to really know that they are rooted in this place, in their body, on their land, you know, we'll bury it somewhere ancestrally significant where that child can return to and always feel at home. So Turanga Waiwai means a place to stand, a place to always come and stand and know where you belong. And so even just thinking about the, you know, ritualistic waste or the treatment of the whenua of the placenta within the institution. And if cultures around the world have known that this organ is sacred and that it matters and it impacts how we land in our bodies and how we complete the cycle of birth, no wonder so many of us walk around disembodied.
Yeah.
No wonder so many of us feel like I don't belong in this place because we haven't completed that cycle.
Yes, I feel that to be true in my whole being.
So that was very, yeah, we ended up having a beautiful ceremony with the whenua and returning it to the land. And it just was like, this is how it's supposed to be. Mm. You know, it's not, it's really very ordinary in its like magic, you know. Mm. It was a very psychedelic experience for me, Zevon's birth. Excuse me. I really felt like multiple presence, you know, my ancestors in the room with me, and I really felt held by the elements of nature that were around me. And then of course grief around like how my daughter and I didn't have that in our experience. And this is where my awakening really, like, you know, started to come in hard and fast as well, where I was like, whoa, you know, I thought this experience that I had was so empowered and was so, like, you know, the pinnacle of birth for me. And now I realize I see all these ways like it was intercepted and interfered with, and it didn't have to be that way, you know. So ultimately, I'm grateful for that first experience, of course. And I always say to my daughter, because she says, oh, the boys were born at home, like, and I was born in a hospital. I said, but you're my greatest teacher.
Yeah.
You know, without that, how would I serve people in the way that I do? How would I have this knowledge that I have if we hadn't lived that experience? It was integral to every decision I made from there, you know? Yeah.
Beautiful. I love that. So with your third, when did you fall pregnant again? Was it soon after, or was there a big gap?
So I fell pregnant after Zevon when he was about one.
Mm.
But at 3 months, we lost that pregnancy. So that baby died, and we had a what they would call a missed miscarriage. So I hadn't had any scans or anything, but I had some bleeding. I went to see Mel. I said, can you let me, like, hear the baby with the Doppler? Couldn't hear anything. And then decided to go and get a scan and saw that the baby had passed away in utero.
Yeah.
And yeah, the advice was go and get the pill, you know, that forces abortion, or go and get a DNC, but we chose to wait and manage at home on our own. And so we managed that with acupuncture and herbs and ritual, and that my body did what it was always going to do, and I managed that at home naturally, and we still were able to birth in a very beautiful way, and honor that life and that the wisdom that came through that experience. So that happened before I fell pregnant with Ember, which was shortly after. So maybe another cycle or two cycles, the early birth.
I love that you mentioned that, and just, you know, for everyone to hear that you can choose to do it at home by yourself, you know, and especially when it comes to, because if you choose to do a DNC, and sometimes that's needed because maybe not everything leaves the uterus and, you know, everything has a time and place. But if you choose the DNC, you are not given the choice to take that baby, or what was going to be a baby, back home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important information I feel like women don't know. And this is a, you know, perfect opportunity to talk about this. Then that, you know, that which would have been your baby, that was the start of life, it's not something that you own and can take home and bury or do ceremony ritual with, which I know many women who listen to this podcast, you know, might want to do if that happens to them. And, you know, it's a fairly common thing for, you know, 1 in 4 women to experience, right? Mm-hmm. So it's common for women to do, have this experience through life, and to have this opportunity to know that you can also choose to actually just wait and see, and also have, you know, herbs or acupuncture and other things that can help alone, but also many times the body will by itself also release.
Yes. I feel like this is still such an area that is that goes untouched.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by virtue of having a womb, like, we are the carriers of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And death is a part of life. Mm-hmm. And that was really the message that came through that experience. You know, I labored for the same length of time that I labored with Zevon.
Mm-hmm.
My waters released, you know, it was a birth. It's not, it's framed as being like a period. You know, it's like period pain. It's not. It's, I was contracting, you know, my waters released, I released placenta and the baby, and, you know, it was, my family was around me and holding space for that experience. Yeah. And the message was like, well, this is part of what it means to, you know, be a carrier of life, is that we are also the doorway to the mystery, and that includes death. And, it was always going to be that way, you know? And I think it's a really hard conversation to say, like, that was a beautiful experience and it had messages, and that spirit that wanted to come through, but it wasn't time, had messages. And my womb had messages like, you can trust me.
Mm.
You can trust me. You trusted me in birth. Trust me to do this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that also, you know, in the medical society, it's not called a stillbirth until, I think it's around 22 weeks or something. The mark is before that, it's a miscarriage. Like, you couldn't carry that baby, so you miscarried. It's such a derogatory way of speaking about it. And also, the grief of losing a baby, especially for someone who wanted that baby, whether that is at, you know, 6 weeks, 16 weeks, or 26 weeks, or 36 weeks, it's still a grief and it's something that should be honored. And we need to have new words put in place for how we speak around women and birthing and all the labels that we put from the medical society is always very derogatory of woman and her process.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just got to keep speaking. Hey, keep speaking about it all.
Yeah. So after that,
after that, we didn't, it was not an intentional pregnancy, but we knew that they were there. We knew that he was there. We knew that we wanted to have another baby. We didn't know that they would come through at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom was like looking after the kids and we made love and it was like a quickie and it wasn't, you know, I was like, I really want to call the baby in and like do all the intentional stuff. And it just wasn't like that. But that's what I'm learning as well, is like the babies are autonomous in this process. Like these spirits, they want to come through and they don't care if you're going to do all of the stuff, you know, when they're ready and they really want to come through. That's been my experience. It's like they come through. So Ember took the opportunity to come through that. And we were excited. We were so excited. It felt right. I moved through a lot of fear around losing him. I felt like death was very present, like next to me, you know, there, having just had the early birth and losing that pregnancy. But that was also in a way like a very beautiful part, you know, of like actually having to face that. And I feel more at peace with death, you know, that anytime we do fall pregnant, it doesn't mean a baby is going to come.
No.
You know, and that's the reality. And we do, when we dance with birth and life, we dance with death and the mystery, and you can't escape that. And that was a big teaching that came through that. It was fucking hard while I was going through it. You know, I was like, there would be days where I'd be debilitated thinking about it and I'm not having symptoms, you know, I'm not feeling sick or my breasts aren't hurting or whatever it was. And Nick would have to remind me, you know, that's okay, that happens. And also like surrender to the mystery and to the process. So we decided we didn't want to have a care provider. I wanted to be my own care provider, which is actually really hard to do if you want to engage the medical system in any way, because I wanted to have a scan. So getting a scan without a official care provider is really bloody hard. So if you don't have a friend, you know, who's able to write referrals or who can, you know, give you the information or the results once they're complete, it can be really difficult. So I was in a privileged position. I obviously have a lot of friends who are happy to subvert the system. And, you know, I was able to go and get the ultrasound that I wanted to get.
Which ultrasound was that? And why did you want that?
I wanted to get a 20-week scan because I just wanted that visual affirmation, you know, like the baby's in there. From what we can see in this moment, knowing that this is just a moment, you know, I can see that everything looks okay. And what actually happened was I got the scan and they found an amniotic band. I don't know if you're familiar with amniotic bands. So when the placenta, when you fall pregnant, the placenta and what is it called? The amnion? Yeah, when everything's kind of developing in there and the layers are getting really lush, sometimes some of that amnion doesn't fuse to the uterine wall and that can create a band. So that can be either a band that's untethered, that's just like a tentacle type thing just in there. It can be multiple or it can be tethered from one side to another and it can be in all different spaces within the uterus. And so they found this like really quite large, thick amniotic band.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was just like a whole journey that I had to go on. I was like, nobody knew about amniotic bands.
Yeah. I can't ever remember ever having any woman having that. So I'm learning something here today. Yeah. I love it.
Nobody, even like the most experienced midwives that I knew, were like, look, I don't know, I can't give you this information. So then I went on my own journey. I found there were only two studies that were written that were done on amniotic bands. And so the risk with an amniotic band is amniotic band syndrome, where a band can wrap around a baby, the fetus, and can cause that fetus harm. So whether that be like the amputation of a limb.
Right.
And then obviously the worst case scenario is death. Mm. But this is super, super duper rare, so rare. Mm. And having an amniotic band does not mean that you are going to have amniotic band syndrome. Mm. And so I read these studies. I found out like where in the uterus it actually poses a risk, which is the only stillbirth cases that they had tracked back to an amniotic band was the amniotic band sitting over the opening, stopping the baby from emerging with ease. So I've read that and I was like, look, I'm all right with the amniotic band. We're going to be okay. You know, it's not, I'm okay with that risk because it's so minute, yeah. So minute. But it definitely was a portal that I had to navigate and had a lot of wonky days, you know, where it was just like, why? A part of me wished I didn't even get the scan.
Mm. Well, this is the risk of the scans, isn't it? Exactly.
You know, it's like I went in there wanting psychological affirmation. You know, like that was for me having had the loss. I wanted a psychological reassurance. It wasn't so much about like I knew the baby was fine. I could feel that, but I wanted it for emotional reasons. And then I go in there and get thrown into this whole other friggin' experience, you know? And so, yeah, I just had to like really surrender. I took control of that situation. I had to advocate for myself to actually get the results with the position of the amniotic band. So the ultrasound people wouldn't give me the results. So then I Googled the guy, the obstetrician who had analyzed the ultrasound and just contacted him directly and went around the ultrasound business and said like, look, this is my situation. I don't have a care provider. I need to know this information so I can make an informed decision. He was like, cool, this, and this, told me how it was. He's like, I don't think you're in risk, but like, that's your decision to make. So chill, so fine, you know? And it was just really nice to have that experience after the gatekeeping.
Yeah.
Because it's just bizarre having to advocate to get information about our bodies.
Yes.
From these organizations. Anyway, so I had that and then I just was like, no more scans, no more bloody anything. I'm just going to like marinate in this pregnancy. We ended up moving to the Northern Rivers, so 8 hours north. And I spent the rest of my pregnancy just going to the beach and being in nature and, you know, doing all the beautiful things. I connected with a really wonderful midwife up here who is supportive of free birth. I wanted her to come and map my belly in the weeks leading up to birth. So she came over and, you know, just like told me everything that was happening with the position of the babe. So I felt I just like to have that information leading up to birth. And Ember's birth began, he was engaged, like deeply, deeply engaged from like 35 weeks. So I felt like this baby is probably going to come early. All of my babies, Aelia came at 39 weeks. Zevon came at 38. I felt like this baby's going to come at 36. That was my intuition. What happened? We made love and almost immediately I started having sensations like tightening. And, you know, we made dinner and we potted around and they were just there like slowly, slowly doing their thing. And then everybody went to bed and I like, you know, went to bed about 10 and then at 11 woke up to it intensifying. And again, I just let everybody sleep and wanted to have that time for myself to just be with the baby. And be with myself before, you know, it all gets how it gets. And I was on the bed on all fours, just like rocking and moaning, and then moved down to the bottom of the bed. And it was just like such a different sensation to my previous birth. So it was, looking back now, I think he was probably getting himself into a position, or maybe he was in a strange position. And so he was really working to like get into the optimal position. Because I was like, what is this baby doing? This is intense. I haven't experienced this feeling before. And I just labored by myself for a while. And then Nick woke up, and it's just this really beautiful, like fluid time between us where we barely spoke. He just kind of, we both went out into the lounge room area, and he started setting up the pool. I started lighting all the candles, putting the music on. We didn't have to say anything or explain anything. It was just like this understanding of what was happening and connectedness. And the sensations that I was experiencing started to get really, really close together and really, really intense. It was like, I felt like a volcano, and there was like the lava inside me, but it couldn't get out. And it was just like this tension that was building and building and building and building, and not getting much reprieve in between the sensations. And so finally the pool was set up, my kids started to wake up, and I got in the pool after this like building and building of the intensity for so long. It was just like, it's like everything just stopped completely. It was like time stopped. Grace entered the room, you know, and it was like 20 minutes because we've set up a tripod with the iPhone. And when I looked back at it, it was 20 minutes of just complete and utter stillness and silence of Nick and I just like with our foreheads together, me on the inside of the pool and him on the outside. And it was just like spirit was just letting me have that time, you know, to just gather myself before the next part. And I, when things started to rise again, I could feel that Ember was in his bag, in his waters. And so the waters were like moving down, and I could feel them starting to emerge, and then they'd go back up and then start to come down and protrude a little bit and go back up. And it was honestly, I wouldn't use the word agonizing to describe my two earlier births. Agonizing. There were moments of true agony within Ember's birth where I was like, what is this? Like, wow. I felt like so rooted in my body. It wasn't psychedelic like Zevon's birth. It was very much like, you are the mountain and you need to be so rooted into the earth right now to be able to get through this experience. There was no thought. It was just like full sensation within my body. Nick was just there being amazing. And I remember being in the pool and feeling the children behind me, and they would whisper to each other or whatever. And then my waters were really, really protruding, and they just released. And it was like the wells of, you know, just the town had been in drought and the wells of water released. And I was just like, ah! It was so just that release and that relief that came. I was like, okay, it's time. Mm-hmm. And I leant back and leant back into the back of the pool and just felt, I put my hand over my vulva and my perineum, and I could feel the expansion. And then, and I loved that feeling of feeling myself expand in that way. And then I felt Ember's little nose, just his little nose and his little mouth. And then I felt him turn himself around into the right position. And then just so slowly, he just like slid out. It wasn't like Zevon. It wasn't like earlier. He just slowly, slowly started coming out. I had my hands down around under his arms, just slowly out of the water and then onto my chest. And he was so covered in vernix. I'm talking like thick, thick layer of vernix.
Yeah, because how many weeks was he?
Probably 36 weeks, 36 and a half weeks. No hair, hardly any body fat. He was just like this tiny white little, we called him Baby Vern for a while, like little Baby Vern. He was so small, but he was just so, that is his, that's his nature, is so slow, so slow, so gentle, no rush, like slow movements. That's how his birth was, is how his nature is. And yeah, and then I, first thing I said was, that was hard. It was so hard, hard work that birth. And then we got out of the pool and all sat on the lounge together, and he had a big feed, and we didn't wash him. We didn't wash the vernix off. We kept him attached to his Fenua for about 12 hours. We did like a partial lotus birth. So we put the flowers and the herbs on and kept him attached. And then it just felt time. It felt like the energy was closed between them. And so then we used our tools. I have them here, of Kunamu greenstone, to sever the cord. And then we kept herbing the placenta for 10 days and kept it next to the bed just till we felt it was time. Like, okay, you can go in the earth now. Ember's ready to be without you. And we didn't weigh him for 4 days. He was still under like 3. He was like 2.9 after 4 days when I weighed him. He was just such a teeny tiny little human. And I just kept him on me constantly. I was like, okay, I don't know how many weeks gestation you are, or like if this is even, you know, maybe you're a little bit premature. I don't know. I think he could have cooked a little bit longer, but he was ready and we were ready to receive him. So.
And, you know, the thing with the whole term, right, is, yeah, most women, most statistically, they say, you know, is between 37 and 42. But for some women and babies, it's normal. It's their normal to be before or after, right? It doesn't mean, you know, that all baby, if you're born like 36 and 5, you know that it's going to be a catastrophe, right? Or the same, especially, you know, going over 42 weeks. I mean, I feel like it's even more babies that are normally going to be birthed between 42 and 43, sometimes even 44 weeks, right?
Yeah. And that was what I kept coming back to with Ember, is how do you seem? You know, like how you're feeding well, you're doing all the things that, you know, show us that you're thriving. And so it's perfect timing, you know, and it's, you're allowed that space when you're doing it yourself. Yeah. You know, for me, it's like free birthing isn't like some statement, you know, or like some fuck you to the system. It's like, this is what is in alignment with what's needed in birth, for birth to unfold optimally. And for me to feel safe, like, what is it that makes me feel safe? I feel safest when I'm with my partner and when I'm with my family, and I feel safe in my space. So it's the progression of my births. It's not without, I'm not fearless. You know, I'm not the world's bravest woman. People say, you're so brave. Oh, you know, I'm too afraid to do that. I had fear. You know, I had things that arose for me and things I have to work through, you know, the amniotic band stuff, like the having miscarried, all of, I'm a human being. Like, I still have fears. I think it's an irrational pressure to put on ourselves that we have to be fearless in order to birth our babies in power. That's just not true. Like, fear, courage is to feel fear and do it anyway.
That's it.
And so that's, you know, I think just alleviating that pressure off ourselves to be like superwoman. You don't need to be superwoman. You're just a human woman, you know, and birth is just a human thing, and your fear is okay. And I really noticed that a lot in like some more like spiritual pre-birthy conversations, is like, you know, there can be a bit of like shaming around not feeling 100% confident, or not 100%, if you don't 100% trust. It's like, well, that's okay if you don't. Like, it's okay if you feel a little bit scared sometimes, or if you want to get a scan, or if, you know, you want to have a midwife come and check you afterwards. Like, you get to choose. how you want your experience to look. You get to choose who you want in your experience.
Mm.
It doesn't make you more or less powerful.
No, you know? Absolutely. And I think that fear is a natural part of birth. Like, birth is the unknown, and it's normal to fear the unknown. I don't think anyone is without fear. Like, it's a part of the human experience to have fear. And as you say, and then to meet that, I think that's where many women then hide or like spiritually bypass, not looking at their fears. Now, that's a different kettle of fish that really would get you into trouble, you know? And I'm very much a big advocate, and I speak of this all the time on this podcast, like, to face your fears. Like, during pregnancy, go through what you're fearing, you know, either with your birth team or, you know, your family, whoever's going to be there, you know, unpack it in yourself. Don't stick your head in the sand.
Yes. And the ways that that then influences and impacts your experience of mothering and your life after giving birth to that child. Because we as a culture are not taught to be with our discomfort on an emotional or spiritual level. You know, it's like anything that is perceived to be dark or makes others around us uncomfortable is shamed or considered bad, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that when we approach the altar of birth, we're not comfortable with being with fear. But it doesn't mean that fear has to control us.
Mm-mm.
Like, having enough space between ourselves as the observer and the experiencer and the emotion to be able to like unpack that. That's a tool that will stay with us for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
And that's like, we are going to be faced with fear and hard decisions constantly as mothers. It's like birth prep is mother prep is life prep, you know?
Yeah, 100%. So the placenta was with you for 10 days and then you buried it on your land?
We buried it in a pot of soil, and I wanted to have this beautiful ritual, but we have like chickens and kids, and so the kids start fighting while we're having this ritual with the placenta. Then the chickens come over and start trying to peck it. Just like, oh my God, just put it in the soil. And so we have it in the soil now. That is, you know, there for when we buy our own property and can put their placentas into our earth. For now, they just sit on our balcony together.
I love that.
Yeah. And then we just, I mean, he's never been to a doctor or a checkup. He's just was born and that's it. You know, it's like, that's how it can be, is that we don't have to do all the things. You can just have a baby and then here they are, and then they're in your family. And, you know, like, it's up to us as the parents to assess how that child seems. Is that child thriving? Is that child putting on weight? Is that child, you know, meeting what we would expect a child, our child to meet? How do we feel intuitively about that child's well-being? And if we feel good about it, then why do we need to have, you know, multiple pediatric appointments or, you know, well checks? We don't have to if we don't want to. I'm not saying that we shouldn't, if that's what feels right, of course, but it's not a must. It's a if you want.
Yeah. Beautiful. So if you had a first-time mama in front of you right now who's about to have her first baby and she really wants to have a natural and empowering birth experience, what advice and pearls of wisdom would you give to her?
So firstly, I would say, where in your line, ancestrally in your lineage, were you, you know, cut from your connection to birth as a normal, natural event? Because if you go back far enough, I can 100% guarantee you that birth was a normal, natural event that women did at home within their kinship circles and family circles, and that exists still in you. You know, and that whilst up here in our intellectual mind, we have all of these stories and the conditioning around birth as being, you know, hard and terrifying and we're incompetent and so on and so forth. Like, the primal brain, the amygdala, remembers. It knows how, because you are an animal and animals know how to give birth. So knowing that about yourself and really leaning into that and feeling how that feels in your body. I would also, and I can be quite blunt in how I convey myself sometimes, but going to a hospital to have a natural physiological birth is like going to McDonald's for a nutrient dense meal. 100%. Like you're not going to get it.
Mm.
And I think we like tap dance around that a little bit too much because we don't want to shame anyone. We don't want to scare people. Mm. But meanwhile, 1 in 3 people in this country are walking away with birth trauma.
100%.
Half of people are having cesareans, you know, or being induced. I don't even know what the numbers are anymore. I'm more interested in people's stories. But going into that system and expecting physiology to be respected and unfold, you know, as it can and will, is naive.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't agree more. I have had experiences of being a warrioress, birth advocate closing the door.
Yes, love it.
But you know, it shouldn't be like that. And if you do walk into hospital wanting to have a natural birth, you do need someone like that with you. And even so, that will not be as undisturbed and as you will never get that full physiology unfolding because it will affect you to travel to the hospital. It will affect you to come into a foreign environment. It will affect you to be in a hospital where you can sense that there's sick people around. It definitely will affect your physiology. And I think that's really important to understand for sure that it is going to be a vastly different experience. And as a birth worker, you know, I know it in every cell of my being. It's such a huge difference being at a home birth compared to being at a birth center birth, which is that in-between space, right? Those two are very different. And then compared to going to a hospital. And then also, what kind of hospital is that? You know, what are their philosophies? They're different hospitals, obviously. And we can have a better or a worse one for sure. But yeah, I think it's important to be truthful around that. And I'm very much like that as well. Like, yes, of course, for some, maybe you need to be in hospital for some certain medical reason, and you can do the best of that with being so informed and like bringing your people with you and creating the best scenario you can. But ultimately, if your desire is to, and you know, you want to have a natural physiological birth, then home is best.
Yes. And we also, you know, I am very aware that 99% of people in this country are going to birth in hospital, you know, so we still need to advocate for systemic change and talk about systemic change and ways to protect yourself when you do enter into that system. So I think having a really strong sense of self and like a really, really deep knowing of who you are, like what your thresholds are, what is how you deal with authority, you know, and this is stuff around like parental stuff and inner child stuff. Like, how do I deal with a perceived authority figure telling me what to do? And what do I do? Do I run? Do I freeze? Do I fight? What is my strategy? Because in the hospital, the OB becomes that person, right? They become symbolic of that, or the midwife becomes that person.
Yes.
And how are you going to feel in that situation when someone's telling you your baby's going to die? Right. And you intuitively feel that that's not true.
Yeah.
And whatever. So I think like the best birth prep you can do is knowing yourself in a really deep way, first and foremost. So if you do have to birth in that system or you want to birth in that system, you can do it with full awareness and knowing like your yeses and your noes in a really powerful way and confident to advocate for yourself in that way, or have people, as you say, around you to advocate for you because you deserve it. It's a thing, like women don't want to cause a fuss a lot of the time. It's like we've been conditioned into like, I'll just do as I'm told, like the good girl archetype. It's like, no, this is your moment.
Mm-hmm.
If there's ever a moment in your life, it's this. And this is imprint for you and your child that will last for the rest of your lives. You know, you deserve to have it in the way that you want to have it.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, 100%. So important. It's yours to claim, not to give away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Amy, for coming and sharing your birthing wisdom with us. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, we could keep yapping for a long time. I think it's clearly both of our favorite subjects. So.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's so nice to reflect on my birth experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah, really beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you love this podcast, then please consider sharing it. Leave a review or make a contribution on our Patreon page. And if you want to connect on social media, then find the podcast on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Thank you for listening.